good. It's a good topic.
Right.
Good topic.
It is a good topic.
Okay. Okay.
Why it's called that.
Okay. So thank you, Javi, for hosting. So we're going to talk about common issues that arise in the context of vacations. I could have had more topics, but I like to figure everything on two sides of the page here. Okay. So, okay, we'll just go through them, I guess. And if you have any clarifying questions, feel free to ask. So, and these were based on questions that were sent to me, that Dina sent me, that different people had. So, I formulated, I organized it based on these questions some people had. So the first we'll talk about is, well, first of all, when you talk about vacation and you're Jews, you have to talk about food. So that's very important. So the first thing is, what about the continental breakfast at a hotel? So I was asked the following question. Is it a Maris Ayin? Is it a Maris Ayin issue to go into the hotel to take some of the food, the continental breakfast? Some is kosher, some is not kosher. By the way, just in terms of different terms, the difference between Maris Ayin and Cheshad, if you've ever heard of those two terms in Halacha, the difference between Maris Ayin and Cheshad, Ches Shin Dalet. Maris Ayin is the concern that someone's going to see you do something and they're going to say, she's a very religious woman, so it must be okay. Maris Ayin is where they're going to see that you're doing something and they're going to think, because you're doing it, so therefore it's okay. Cheshad, that Cheshad comes to word to mean suspect. So they will, Cheshad means that they are going to suspect that you're doing something wrong. Like both, sometimes they use interchangeably, but they're really two different concerns. One is they're concerned that if you're doing it, then it's okay. And Cheshad is where they suspect that you're doing something wrong. So this is not, so someone asked, is it Maris Ayin to get food from the hotel breakfast buffet? So it's not a Maris Ayin, because it's very common for Orthodox Jewish people to eat only kosher food from these breakfasts. It's not reasonable for people to think that an Orthodox Jewish person would eat non-kosher food there. Mayor of Schechter spoke about this, about the context of going to a non-kosher restaurant and getting a fruit salad there. He thought that's so common. It's common. No, it's reasonable to assume that you're only going to have a fruit salad, at least in New York. It happens so often. So there's not really a Maris Ayin issue to partake in these breakfasts. I was also asked, like, is there a different hashgacha, like, I don't know, when you're on vacation or not? For the most part, no. Okay, for the most part, I think we're not going to talk about this. It could be a topic in the future, the coffee, the Starbucks, you can't get a Starbucks. So Starcade does have certain leniencies when you're on the road. There are some situations where halacha is, let's say, is strict, but under pressing circumstances, you could rely on a minority view. So
bidyevet
means like, right, if something's already done by a shasat chav, a pressing situation. Right. So I think when it comes to coffee, you can look at the Starbucks website, certain things are bishasat chav, life's going to end if you don't have your coffee. So there are some distinctions. Okay. But for the most part, the rules are the same. It's important to find out that, some food don't require hashgacha. Some food, that's a general conversation. That's a general, topic. You can always ask me, is this a good hashgacha? People frequently email me, text me, and I try to find out for them. Some foods do not need hashgacha. But generally, there's for the most part, the same standards do apply. Regarding what utensils. So as a general rule, it's obviously better to use plastic utensils at a breakfast buffet. But in reality, if everything is cold, the Ramon, Yeridea, Simon, Kuf, Chaf, Aleph, Saif, Hey writes that you're allowed to use non-kosher utensils for eating cold food on an occasional basis, be'akrai, on an occasional basis. The theory being that, again, assuming everything is clean, you have to make sure everything's clean. When it comes to kashrus, you're worried about two things. You're worried about many things, but in general, you're worried about, I have two different categories. You're worried about actually eating non-kosher food or non-kosher residue, or that you're concerned about eating non-kosher taste. Okay? So when it comes to, let's say, a clean a cereal bowl, whatever, if they had a cereal bowl, a clean a metal spoon. So for the most part, what's the concern? If it's clean, there's no non-kosher residue, and if everything is cold, there's no transfer of taste. Okay? The only time we're concerned with the potential transfer of taste with cold foods is, let's say, a sharp food. Like if you're cutting, let's say, an onion with a non-kosher knife, so maybe there's taste transfer. But generally speaking, you know, that doesn't really apply. You know, sometimes, I don't know, I remember, you know, there's the issue when you go out for a picnic or you go on one of these picnic tables, and if you, like, some people think if you put your food on the picnic table, everything becomes treif. It's not sanitary to do that. But the truth is, you know, if your food falls directly on the table, they just have to make sure that, you know, it shouldn't happen. If it falls, it doesn't make it automatically non-kosher. You're concerned about residue, about non-kosher residue, and then you're concerned about the taste. So if you're dealing, again, if you have plastic, if there's always paper or plastic, so I try to use that, paper or plastic, just because I don't have to forget in case there's something hot, you know, whatever the case is. Maybe there's, oatmeal with a hashgacha and hot water. So, like, as for the most part, so there you might run into a problem of having a bowl that might be non-kosher bowl and use it for hot. So that we don't do. The Ramah is lenient only when it comes to if it's cold and it's an occasional basis. So this case would be just going to a hotel. That would be an occasional basis. But again, just to try to avoid it, if there's plastic or paper, I generally want to do that just in case I forget. But you do have this possibility. Then I have one E in terms of hard-boiled eggs. Some people think they get hard-boiled eggs. So that's a problem, one of two reasons. Number one is they may have been cooked in a non-kosher pot. What's wrong with an egg? You know, an egg is an egg. There's nothing non-kosher about an egg. But if they're cooked in a non-kosher pot, so that's a problem. You don't know for sure that all the pots are only cooking eggs. I don't think we can rely on that. And the other more serious problem, I'm not sure one is more or less serious, but there's bishalako. Bishalako means that the food that's completely kosher, the food that's completely kosher, but it's cooked by a non-Jew, so then we're going to talk about some other foods, so that would be, you can't eat that food if it's cooked by, if it's fully cooked by a non-Jew. So if they have, you know, a tray of hard-boiled eggs, so they cook the hard-boiled eggs, that's a bishalakum problem. And generally speaking, there are two leniencies when it comes to bishalakum. If the food is generally eaten raw, if it can be eaten raw, so I don't know, like, you know, some people do that. Right? Like sometimes they eat, you know, the liquid egg. I mean, nobody does that, right? Some people are trading with eggs. What? Yeah, yeah. That's not safe, right? Yeah. So that. Yeah, athletes. Yeah, yeah. You always see these athletes. Yeah, I'm not holding them to these concepts. But so for the most part, if the food can be eaten raw, or it's something that would not be served at a king's table, at a presidential table, there's a discussion what, you know, how to define what types of foods. But for our purposes, an egg, you can't eat it raw, and it's not fit, and it is fit to be served at a king's table. You have, presidents do have eggs for breakfast, it's a regular food. And therefore, so we shouldn't get the hard-boiled egg. You can get, this is one F, you can get whole fruit and whole vegetables, assuming there aren't insect infestation issues, right? That there are these websites which talk about insect infestation issues, but you can't have whole fruits and whole vegetables. What about cut fruit and cut vegetables? Okay, so the answer is the following. I had a conversation with Rabbi Eli Gersten. I always get nervous because whenever I talk about this, I want to make sure that I'm right. So I always call him again every time. So because he wrote an article about this, he works for the OU, and essentially, Even if, let's say, a non-kosher knife, let's say, for example, so what's the concern? If you have cut up fruit or cut up vegetables, so the concern might be maybe the knife was used for some non-kosher food and there's residue on the knife. So sometimes it's hard to, even if they wash it off, the question how to, let's say the knife was used for non-kosher food, so how do you ensure that all the residue is off. So There's something called ne'itza, sticking in the ground 10 times, or there's a question of how to clean it. Not simple, just washing it with some soap in the sink. Not so clear whether that will suffice if there is really non-kosher residue. So the concern is that they use the knife for non-kosher, now they're cutting the fruit. And so the red non-kosher residue is getting on the fruit. So based on the Shulchan Aruch and Yeridea, Simon, Sadi, Vav, Seif, Dalit, so the halacha is that if a non-kosher knife was used to cut a large number of fruits, so you're allowed to assume that the residue got onto the first few fruits, and what you're having is not that. This is explicit in the Shulchan Aruch. And what Rabbi Gerson told me, he says, there's a difference if you order for your own serving of like cut up fruit, so that's a problem. Because that's probably not large enough. But if they're putting out for a continental breakfast, the whole, you know, assortment of fruit, they just put it out. So he thought that would be okay. We wouldn't be concerned. We can assume that even if there was non-kosher taste, so then it dissipated.
Because of the amount?
Yeah, because the amount, that you could assume you're allowed to assume that what you're having is probably not one of the first fruits, and one of the first vegetables. You could rely on the majority that's probably not, and you can eat. This is actually a very explicit halacha in the Shulchan Aruch where he said you can rely on this.
Rabbi,
so supermarket also, so but they probably also do it bulk.
Right, they eat the
right.
Portion.
Yeah, yeah, they do it bulk. So you're right. So the truth is, in restaurants, it's actually more problematic. And a lot of people say they go to a restaurant, they get the cut of fruit. So I had this conversation with him. So he's concerned because it depends on the restaurant. Like I would say like this, if you know 100%, he said, I'm not a bulky in restaurants. You know, some of these fancy restaurants, they're going to say, we only use, you know, knives wholly dedicated to fruit. You know, I'm not an ex. I don't know much about restaurants in terms of if that's the case. Because let's say in the kitchen of a restaurant, a lot of stuff is going on. So question is, can you truly rely in a restaurant when they're serving an individual portion that they are cutting, they're running around and just give me this knife and cut. I don't know enough about that to know whether that's true or not. He wasn't sure about that, but he felt like he said in his article, he wrote it again, like a big grocery store where they serve a lot, so that he felt that you can rely on that. Yeah.
Some restaurants like prep for a lot of people. I don't think they're personally cutting fruit. I think it's just put it together.
I don't know I can't answer that because I don't know for sure. I you might be right. On the other hand, you could say that maybe they have a lot of whole fruits. They could. I know what their prep is like. Their prep might be, we have a lot of whole fruits, and then when someone orders, they want to be very fresh. Maybe at that point, then they start cutting up. And if the things are going on, will they slip another knife? I don't know for sure. I can't comment on that definitively. Yeah.
Some of these states have those laws about dedicated.
Yes.
You know, and cruise ships, it's a law for cross contamination.
Right. So that might be right.
Vegetables are only in the vegetable.
I mean, yeah. Yeah. So right. So if they let you see it, if there are laws, so I think that might be very different. I would agree with you.
Maybe
that would be different.
For
yeah. Yeah. No.
For that, illness, not
yeah. Yeah.
For
right. Right. That's it. That's
not right.
So I think. So it's interesting. So I think. So I actually asked this question. What about in terms of like you say? If you tell me I have allergies. So I'm not sure. I think allergies may only be with shell. I'm not sure allergies necessarily with meat. I'm not sure if it's with everything. But I agree with you. If it's something where like it's illegal and they could be, you know, sued for it, and they're really afraid of being caught. That's
well,
really the question.
On a cruise ship, a fast.
Yeah, yeah. So right. So that I think that might be a little bit different, right?
I'm sorry, I have a question. It makes a difference. Most of the people, they might not be Jewish people, so is it okay that they are cutting all this fruit if they're not Jews?
Yeah, they can do that. You have to assume that, well, the question is, what are you concerned about? They can touch, non-Jews can touch your fruit. The issues are bishalakum. You know, they can't cook. There are rules about cooking food, them cooking food. There are rules about, you know, yayin stam yenam, wine, that's not mevushal, that's not, right, that's, There are certain rules, but in general, for a non-Jew, handle your food is not an issue. You may not be able to trust. There might be trust issues in terms of saying, can I be sure that he or she is doing what I think he or she is doing? So there could be trust issues. But again, if someone's cutting fruit, so that's the question. What's the concern? So worst case scenario, maybe they, let's say in these, like let's say in our case, right, in a hotel. So maybe they're using the same knife for something else. If they're cutting a whole bunch of fruit, so you're allowed to rely on the fact that the first few, you know, that you're allowed to rely that your fruit is probably not among the first few fruits, and that it should be okay. Okay, so now, so something, I don't know if it's ever happened to you, it's happened to me before, you know, they tell you, you're so excited when they tell you that, oh, we're getting these kind of bagels. Ever have that? And like you're looking for the label and you can't find it. and you're like trying to track it down and like, so this is a question, like, you know, can you, so obviously the best thing, it seems you need some kind of documentation. And if you have here's the concern, right? They tell you, we get all of our bagels from Mr. Kosher Bagel, okay? With Rabbi Kosher Bagel, it's hashgacha. Let's say it's a reliable hashgacha. Again, let me make this very clear. Maybe it's obvious for many of us. Not every hashgacha that's out there is reliable. Feel free to contact me. I'll try to find out as quickly as I can. Some are reliable. Some are not reliable. Not every vegan restaurants are not necessarily reliable. There are many additives in vegan restaurants that are not kosher. So we have to be. Maybe I'm saying the obvious. The anything that doesn't have hashgacha, you should contact me just to find out. Does this need hashgacha? Does not need hashgacha? Like for the most part, vegan restaurants are a problem because there are so many different additives, ingredients here and there that might not have hashgacha, different oils. But in any case, so regarding the bagels, so the concern is that maybe they're good. They say we get bagels from this kosher bagel place, and what if they ran out? So they'll get it from, like, in other words, they have a deal where they're getting a lot of bagels at a good price. And let's say they ran out. So what are they doing? They'll get it from, you know, next door. They're paying a little more, but they're getting you bagels. So you need to get really documentation to say that they, what did I write here? You need to get documentation that the bagels that the hotel has that day came from that particular store. You need to have, you know, either it should be like a seal or something or a receipt to say we have, some of the stuff is a little bit of a guesswork, but you need some kind of documentation where they said, you can call them in advance. Say, can you please save the packaging? Can you please save the packaging? Can you please save the receipts? I would say, again, if they have a receipt for, whatever, 200 bagels, and it was dated this date, and you see the wrapping, you know, and they emptied it out, but you see the wrapping for that day, I think that you could rely on. But just for them to say, we have bagels, you know, we got that, so... for the most part, you need real documentation because in case they run out. Okay, does that make sense? I mean,
Is it any different if it's a Jewish person that's telling you that they got the bagels?
They'd have to it'd have to be a frum person. A Jew is not something's more challenging.
Aware of that, like,
no, not even someone's aware. But you can't. They have no nemanos. And there's someone, whether they're Jewish, you could have non-Jews, right? I'm sure you've been to places, like in some of these cruises, you have the frumest non-Jews who are so sensitive to Jewish concerns. So the issue always is with these things is that sometimes, in a pinch, see, we hopefully, that we who take our kashrus and our Shabbos and our halacha seriously, in a pinch, even if it means we have to throw out stuff, even if it means we have to, you know, hopefully, for the most part, we're going to throw out the food if we think it's not kosher. So they will not, in a pinch. That's what we're concerned about for a lot of these things. A lot of these things, are that, of course they want to accommodate the Orthodox Jews, but let's say they feel, oh my gosh, I wasn't able to get the bagels, they're going to be so unhappy, they're going to give me a bad online report, so I got to do something quickly. And they'll rationalize because it says kosher style, so it's fine. And that, what I'm saying is, so they may have, you know, it's like, I remember this when I was an attorney, so like, the last thing you want is for your secretary to say, for your birthday, I'll bake you a cake. And I got all kosher ingredients. I'm saying, because, like, and then you feel like, what's Tom and what's the was it Eino Ben Yomo, was the cake, you know, like so like with even when they think they know, and even but even number one, they may not know everything, and secondly, they have no nemanus. Again, we're concerned about those situations where in a pinch, so some will say, you know what, like just for shalom, for kavod avrios, shalom bayis, make everyone happy, you know, let me just tell, I'll tell the person that we got the food from here. That's what we're concerned about for these things. So there's no difference whether they're a Jew or not Jew. The concern will be maybe if they could be sued, like if it's a legal issue, potentially. You know, like I'll give, for example, like I'll tell you, the mainstream hashgacha organizations say that you need, if you go into a Haagen-Dazs or a Baskin-Robbins or any of these places, you have to check the tub if there's no hashgacha. Don't they sign contracts that every ingredient they have, it has to be kosher? So there, again, the position of most major kosher organizations, as far as I know, is that we're concerned that if they run out, all of a sudden, they'll get something, no one's going to catch them. So even if they're legally required to do something, so the question is, how much is that will stop them from, if they're in a pinch of doing something, doing something that's not appropriate. I mean, there's always something where they could do something that's not appropriate, and they won't get caught. There's always that possibility. Okay, the last thing here is in one eye, which is unflavored coffee is acceptable, as is milk. Hot water from an urn can be used. Waffle mixes, okay? Even if there is a kosher certification, and your kids are so excited because the waffle mixes have kosher certification, sorry, okay? You can't use it because at times they may run out of, even if they tell you, we always get this, let's say they tell you, we always get this, you know, Mr. Kosher waffle mixed, okay? But one day they might run out and they'll use Mr. Non-Kosher waffle mix and they will use it for the griddle, okay? So in other words, what you could do is bring your own griddle, bring your own sandwich maker or something, like something. No, it's something you can bring your own. I think we did that once. I think one time we knew they had kosher, like, pancake mixes or something, so we just bought, we brought our own. It was a question, were we allowed to, we asked them, but like, were we allowed to plug it in to make our own, whatever, the sandwich, we made our own batter, whatever. The batter was kosher, so we brought our own electric, mini thing, whatever, and we were to make waffles, I guess, yeah.
Well, but they have, some places have a machine.
Right.
That's sitting there, they have the waffle mix,
right,
which would read.
Right.
You pour it, the machine only makes waffles or pancakes. It's just keeps
no,
pouring.
No, but what I'm saying is, yesterday they had non-kosher stuff run through it.
Right.
So that's what you're concerned about. They may have had non-kosher stuff run through it. Yeah.
My question is two things. One with the urn, you have to be concerned with how they wash your urn.
If it's for water, then you could generally assume that it's for water. And if there's always hot water going in, then it's always koshering itself. For the most part, if they say this is for hot water, you could rely. The kosher people told me that you could rely if they tell you it's only for water, then you could rely on it being used for water. We're gonna talk also about that, about, you know, the coffee makers in the hotel rooms. If there's always unflavored coffee, which is kosher, or only coffee that's kosher, you said you're allowed to rely that's presumably what they have all the time. Like, in other words, that's what they, that you could ask, but if they tell you that's always hot water, then you could rely on that. Okay, so other kosher issues at a hotel. So again, I'm telling you, my posek for these issues is Rabbi Willig. So there are some who are strict. Rabbi Willig says that you could ask the hotel staff to bake salmon in the oven if it's double wrap, because salmon, people, I don't know if you ever heard of a food called sushi. Okay, so people, since, remember, in order for something to be a problem of bishalakum, it cannot be eaten raw. So salmon is sometimes eaten raw as part of sushi, and therefore, it's just like, you know, it's like any other food. Like, say, you're non-Jews allowed to cook fruit for you, you know, or cook vegetables for you. Since the vegetables, the fruit can be eaten raw, so then there's no problem with bishalakum, so therefore they can bake the salmon for you. There are those who are stringent. Some argue, I think the Rav Schachter disagrees, and they'll argue that when do we say, in other words, that, sorry, the the people don't eat salmon by itself raw. They eat salmon raw together with rice and other things, but they don't eat salmon raw by itself. So therefore, you can't.
Sashimi,
but that apparently is like not a lot of people eat that. I don't know what the number is. I don't know what's considered like. Do people not eat it? But my point to you is, again, I follow Rabbi Willig, so I think you can do it. But I'm saying there are those who are strict. Yes.
But you can rely on them that they'll double wrap it.
No, you double wrap it.
Oh.
No, I would double wrap it.
And then give it to them.
You give it to them, and they put it in. Right. Yeah. Double wrap. Yeah. Yeah.
So I know it's salmon because you can tell by the color.
Right.
But now you can tell that something is tuna, like the red tuna.
I don't know the answer to that question. I will. Is it red tuna?
It's a specific color. And nothing else is that color.
Okay. I'll look into it and I'll let the group know. I don't know the answer right now to that question. I don't know. Yeah.
Didn't you say there was a part two to Bishul
Akum?
Something about on a king's table?
On a what? Yes. It has to be typically served presidential. Yes.
So something that. So that makes it okay.
No, that makes it not okay.
So we don't serve salmon to the...
No, I'm sorry. If either one, if it's... I'm sorry. Okay. In order for something to be subject to the prohibition of Bishul Akum, it has to be both not eaten raw, and also it has to be something that is fit to serve for a king. Because if it's not something that's a chashiv type food, maybe some candies, there might be certain types of foods. It's not really relevant for most foods. So here, the way we're trying to get out of it is to say that it could be eaten raw. Now, there's a theory behind that, is that if it could be eaten raw, they're not doing such a great thing for you because it could already be eaten. It's not a major transformation of the food. So that's, again, so there is a machlokas, but Rabbi Willig told me that it's okay. And you would not, for example, a potato, the whole discussion is a potato, is that, there's a whole discussion whether a potato is meant to be served what about French fries, not, so the whole discussion about that. In practice, you talk about potato chips, whatever, there's a whole discussion about potatoes. But in any case, so potatoes, you cannot just give it double wrap to a non-Jew to warm it up. To cook it in the oven. You can take a baked potato that's already baked and they can always heat up something. There's no prohibition of Bishul Akum to reheat food. There's only a prohibition to cook food. So let's say you bring food from home and you want them to just heat it up in the oven for you. Not a problem. Obviously everything should be double wrapped. Okay, everything should be double wrapped. Okay? So that is 2A. 2B, hotel rooms often come with a coffee maker. By the way, I'll try to send, how should I, well, we'll talk about it afterwards. I'll make it to send this outline if people want it afterwards. Okay. So the hotel rooms provide a coffee maker and kosher coffee. Again, unflavored coffee is kosher. Many of the coffee maker use individual hot cups into which the coffee drips. In this instance, the machine is used for coffee only, and therefore, you could assume that if this is the coffee that they're serving, that this is the coffee they served yesterday, and therefore you can make coffee in this type of machine. If they provide a Keurig coffee maker and only has kosher coffee cups, that you could assume that only kosher coffee was used, and you can make coffee in the Keurig machine. However, if let's say the hotel is so nice that not only do they provide the Keurig machine, not only do they provide this kosher coffee, but they even provide hot cocoa cups, but they aren't kosher. So then, what's the concern? The concern is that maybe right before the last guest left, they made themselves a cup of hot cocoa. And then they made the Keurig non-kosher. Okay? But not all is lost if you're staying for more than one day. Okay? So the first day is a problem. So you would have to wait 24 hours from when the guest had to check out. Okay, so let's say, I don't know, they have to check it.
Check-in.
Yeah, but sometimes they, you know, you throw up your bunk. It's late extended, okay? Or an extension, okay? So then, so if there's also non-kosher coffee, or, right? Or non-kosher coffee, or hot cocoa, so then you wait 24 hours, then you remove the K-cup holder, you pour boiling water over the K-cup holder, and then you run hot water through the entire system. Okay, so again, if there's kosher coffee, kosher coffee, you could rely and you could use it. If there's not kosher, you'd have to wait 24 hours in kosher. Yeah.
Why do you assume that someone didn't just bring in their own that's not kosher?
Uh-huh. So no, I said no. You can't. He said you don't have to. You don't for a suffix. You don't. He thought you didn't have to. You didn't have to worry about that. It's not that common. So he felt you don't have to. He said you don't said generally speaking. No, as I'm saying, right? Because people generally they use what people bring. He said you don't have to rely. That's on comments. You don't really have to rely on that. You don't have to assume that necessarily. To kosher the microwave in a hotel room, so you should clean the microwave. Now again, so this is something that so let me make this very clear that sometimes when you are koshering something, a utensil that is. Let's say you have a metal pot that's not kosher, and you want to kosher it. You generally have to wait 24 hours because we're concerned that let's say you're koshering it. Let's say you have a small pot and you're putting it into a big pot right away. So the concern is that when you put it in the big pot, when you put it in boiling hot water, so the non kosher taste is being removed from the pot. Okay, but through being immersed in the hot water. But if it's less than 24 hours, so then we're concerned that the taste is still significant in the pot. The taste is still potent. The non-kosher taste is still potent in the pot. And then even though it's drawn out, it will go back in. If it's more than 24 hours, there's very negligible taste. And there's a rabbinic rule that you have to kosher it. There's a rabbinic rule that you have to kosher it because we don't want to make a distinction between because maybe if we tell you don't have to kosher after 24 hours, then you might forget even less than 24 hours. But the bottom line is that you generally have to wait 24 hours when you're koshering kelim, when you're koshering utensils. However, when you're koshering an oven, that same concern doesn't apply. Remember, when it comes to, let's say you're koshering a fork. A non-kosher fork, and you're koshering in a big pot. So the concern is, if it's 2 hours after you use it for non-kosher, the non-kosher taste in the water goes out, and then because the water will go back into the fork. When you're koshering an oven, you can kosher right away. There's no concern about liquid going in and out. So my point is, and this is so what it means is, if you have a non-kosher oven, you have a non-kosher microwave, you do not have to wait 24 hours. For a clean, in other words, when you're koshering through liquid heat, so then you have to wait 24 hours. Mm-hmm. When you're koshering through steam, when you're koshering just through dry heat, like in an oven, you don't have to wait. You don't have to wait 24 hours. Again, some of the kosherizations are strict. I find not only my willing is lenient, and I think his argument is very compelling as well, actually. So you don't have to wait 24 hours for the microwave. Now, the only thing is, once you kosher the microwave, so there still is a concern about the glass bottom. So the glass really doesn't become kosher or kosherized, because if the glass became treif because hot liquid sort of spilled on it, or non-kosher liquid spilled on it, so the steam doesn't kosher it. So we're only concerned let's say the whole microwave is kosher, and then you have this glass plate, and then you put another plate on top, and you put the food on top. If there's no spillage, so then we're not concerned about, then it's okay if the plate is non-kosher. Why? Because there's no non-kosher taste, or taste only transfers through a liquid medium. Mm-hmm. The halacha is there's no taste that transfers from one utensil to another utensil. So if you have just the glass plate, and you put another plate, and you put food on top, so technically speaking, that would be okay. As a general rule, it's probably better to just either double wrap the glass plate.
Or a plastic throwaway plate.
Or put a plastic plate, another plate on top of it, right, just to be on the safe side in case there's spillage. I'm just trying to give you the, I'm just telling you the theory. I'm saying in practice, what I wrote here on the outline, that you should replace the plate on the bottom of the microwave or double wrap the glass plate in plastic wrap or whatever, and wax paper, whatever it is, because in case there's out of a concern of spillage. I'm saying in truth, if you're warming up something that's, I don't know, solid and there's no spillage, then it's fine. But technically, it's fine. I'm just trying to tell you what, you know, practically speaking, someone may forget that they'll think we could always use it, that there could be, that you use it for liquid. So I think it's the best policy in general is that with the glass plate, either replace it or put another plate on top of it, or double wrap it. Okay? I saw on one particular kosher website that said, that there's an issue if you bring meat or fish that in your hotel room, you would have to label it. Why? There's a halacha called basar shedis alei min ha'ayin, that if meat, that we're strict, that if meat is not in your view for a while, then maybe someone tampered with it. We're very strict with meat. And so that basar that was hidden from the eye, that you don't know where it is the whole time, or you don't, you know, then unless it's sealed appropriately, then maybe it was tampered with. So there was a particular, one of the websites that talked about these things, and they're concerned about this. Rabbi Gersten from the OU was not concerned about this. He thought that you can leave meat or fish in your hotel room's refrigerator unsealed, and we're not concerned that when the cleaning lady or the cleaning man, whoever it is, comes in to clean your room, that they all say, this looks good. Let me exchange that with another piece of non-kosher meat. Okay? So but I tell you, they're dealing with this halacha, basar shedis alei min ha'ayin. That's an example where you're dealing with someone, let's say, even if they're not Jewish, they're not going to, it's not even in their thought process. They could get fired if they caught, it's not in their thought process. So I did see a website that said they are concerned, but Gerson thought that's not a concern. Okay, now hotels on Shabbos. Now we can go through this very briefly. There are a number of issues relating to a Shabbos at a hotel. It's recommended that you deal with them before you get to the hotel, if you can. Because sometimes you're like, come Shabbos, oh my gosh, the light turns on here, this or this, and like, try to anticipate beforehand. Okay? Try to anticipate beforehand in general. Like, you know, you try to make your itinerary beforehand. So try to anticipate a lot of these Shabbos issues before you book with the hotel, or if it's too late now, before you arrive there, just so you can plan accordingly. Sometimes you can plan all you want and things happen, but try the best you can. So the Shulchan Aruch in Aruch Chaim, Simon, Shin Zayin Seif Hei states that we may tell a non-Jew to set aside a rabbinic prohibition for a tzorech gadol, for tzorech harbe, for a great need. It's a shvus de shvus. It's a double rabbinic prohibition for a great need. There's one rabbinic prohibition, which is telling a non-Jew to do a malacha, work for you on Shabbos. That's one prohibition. And now you're telling him, I want you to do something that for me would only be forbidden rabbinically. That's another level of less severity. And so, if there's a great need, so we say that's permitted. So certainly, in a pressing situation, you could tell a non-Jew if you can't get a key lock. And when I was at the OU West Coast Convention speaking about a month ago. So I still remember, I was in LA about 18 years ago, and I was a rabbi there, and they had this hotel where they had keys. Like, if you want, you have mechanical keys. And they still had them 18 years later, Baruch Hashem, for the from Jewish community. I guess a lot of them come to that hotel. So, right? Yeah, they also go there. So they had keys. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. Okay. So that's great. But most of them probably do not. So the magnetic keys, so you'd want to get the non-Jew to open it for you. So I'm just telling you, it's questionable. There are some heterim, there are some leniencies. Because it says you're all, it's you're allowed to tell a non-Jew to do it if it's a pressing situation. The question is, going on a vacation, staying at a hotel, is that a pressing situation? In other words, as opposed to doing something else, it's not considered a pressing situation. You need to get away from your kids or your grandkids. You got to go away. You got to go to this particular place. Okay, fine, maybe. But, you know, it's questionable. There's a Rabbi Zilberstein who suggested, you know, what you should do is, if you want to get into your room, you tell the non-Jew, I have a gift for you because you've done such a wonderful job for me. I've left... a food basket for you. It's just here, you know, go into my room, you can get it. They're doing it for themselves, they're not doing it for you. They open the door, you're like, wait, don't close the door now. You jump in the room, okay? So, like, okay, because what? You bring a fruit basket. You put it in your room, and you tell them, "I have something for you. Please go inside." You know, so they're doing it for them, not for you. So that is totally legitimate. There are some who are lenient for a variety of reasons, but you know, it's best to try to see if you could avoid. If you can avoid a situation, some places allow you to tape. Some hotels may allow you to tape up the doors, the locks. If you have a lot of valuables, you may not want to do that. So this is an issue. This is an issue. There are some who are lenient, but this is a little bit. It's obviously better to try to avoid having the non-Jew open for you. But you know that Rabbi Zilberstein is a good solution. Again, there are those who say that if you tell beforehand. And there are people waiting for you to open the doors for you. There are many who come up with different leniencies. My will is not so excited with a lot of different leniencies. If you're stuck, then you can rely on it. If you thought you made accommodations and you tried and it didn't work out, let's say you heard about this shit right now and I'm going to lose thousands of dollars. So that could be a major loss now. So then you could rely on it. But in general, we should try to see if we could try to avoid that situation. Yeah. What do you mean? They're turning out for you or for them?
They come in the room where they turn off your shop's lamp or they...
For what reason? Because they're used to it?
They turn off the lights.
No, if they do it for them, totally for them, not for you, then it's totally fine.
But what if you want to ask them to turn it off?
So if you want them to turn it on, I'll tell you the specific case. If you want to tell a non-Jew to turn on a light for you in your room on Shabbos, and there is an already existing light, then you may hint to the non-Jew. Okay? Hinting, I'm not going to go through, I'll try to answer all the fact patterns. Let me explain this why. The reason why this is permitted, okay, is that you are allowed to, this actually is somewhat relevant, I didn't put it on the list, but maybe I'll add it. I would turn off and turn on. Okay, so if there is some light in the room, and you want it to be brighter, or if you want them to turn off the light. So this is what's known as an indirect benefit or an additional benefit. Okay? For both of these cases, I don't have the siman on me, but it's around here in the Shin Zayin in the Archaim. In both of these cases, you're allowed to hint to the non-Jew in order to do this. Okay? By the way, my other time with the key to tell him to open the door, that you're allowed to say directly. That's what's called the shvus, b'makom tzorach. If there's a great need, and there's a double rabbinic, there's a two levels rabbinic that, you know, it's a, you're talking to non-Jew to do something that's rabbinic for a great need, you could tell the non-Jew directly. For an additional benefit or an indirect benefit, an indirect benefit is also, you can't sleep, so you want the light to go off. Both of those, you're allowed to tell a non-Jew indirectly. Now, what is it? You're allowed to hint to a non-Jew. What is the definition of, what's a halachic hint? Okay, a halachic hint, it's very clear, it is you don't tell the non-Jew what to do, and you don't mention the malacha, the act. What you do is, you describe the situation. You describe the situation. I would like to go to sleep. And they're going to say, do you want me to turn off the light? You cannot say yes. Because when you say yes, you're saying, yes, I want you to turn on the light. You said, can I turn off the light? You say, so then you can even tell them, I am forbidden to tell you what to do. But you can even say, I'm a religious Jew, I cannot tell you what to do, but it is But it is. But I cannot tell you what to do. But I'm trying to get to sleep, and it's very bright in here. You the key for hinting is describing the situation. That's how you remember.
You're not giving an order to do.
No, that. I'm saying you don't give an act. You don't mention the malacha. You can't mention the act. You can't say, "Oh, it would be great if someone would turn off the light." So there, you're not telling what to do. But that would not be allowed either. So describe the situation, or where you have, let's say, there's some light here. Oh, it would be great if it would be brighter here. It'd be great. And so what? Yeah, that would be okay because you're describing the situation. And then if they say, "Do you want me to turn on the light?" So you have to say, "I cannot tell you what I'm forbidden according to Jewish law. Tell you what to do." And they'll look at you weird. And they'll realize, "Oh yeah." And then they'll realize, "Oh yeah, someone did that to me last week also." But that's the key, okay? So let me make this clear. Let me make this clear so you remember. Let me just get you to remember. When you're talking about, let's say using electricity for a need, let's tzorech. We can find what a tzorach is. You can say it directly. It's a double rabbinic. Shus. If it's something that's indirect benefit or an additional benefit, that you have to hint. Hinting is describing the situation. Okay. Now, there, you should try. This is not easy. this see if you can figure this out beforehand, depending on the hotel. You should try to avoid entering a... So let me get back to my other case. So if it was pitch black in your room and to have a non-Jew turn it on, that is a problem. That is a problem because that is not an additional benefit. In other words, if there's a little bit of light, if you can see under present circumstance, but it'll be nicer if it's a brighter, be nicer if it'd be brighter, that's called the lusha, the language of the Mishnah Berurah. I don't have the source in front of me, is that you can still see the light, you can still see bishas hadchak under present circumstances. But when you can't see at all, and it's pitch black, so then to turn on light, so that would be forbidden. Okay, that would be forbidden. And by the way, I'm sorry, one second. And then I'll take a question. Obviously, like if you have a child who's very cold, so then you could tell Nadu directly because everyone, even if everyone's freezing, because then everyone, well, if it's winter and everyone's freezing. And they need to turn on the heat, so they said there's a halacha kol choli meitzel tzida. Everyone's considered a chola when it comes to cold air. If you're dealing with a chola and a young child that were concerned that they have a need, they could get sick, so then we're much more lenient. You can even tell a non-Jew to set aside a Torah prohibition. Okay? Sorry for sharing.
No, I was just going to say,
walking
through a pitch dark room, that's dangerous. Right. You could hurt yourself. So
yeah,
I don't understand why.
So it depends. I would say like this. If it's completely, you're right. If it's completely pitch black, and so the concern is you might get injured. But I'd say I'll tell you. If let's say your hotel room is pitch black. So what I would do probably, I would open the door. The hallway light is open. I try to maneuver, so it's not, you know, so it's not a problem. If you're in a situation where it's like, b'makom tsar lo gazru rabbanon, in the case of pain, distress, the rabbis won't make a decree. So if you're in a situation where someone could really in danger of getting hurt, let's say a very elderly person, there's room to potentially be lenient. But I would say if I would walk into my hotel room and it was pitch black, so I would open the door, let the hallway light, you know, stay on until we are prepared. I try to avoid it if I can. Frida, the question?
Yeah, I'm just asking if the air conditioning is the same as the light.
In heat, in extreme heat, we...
So she mentioned air conditioning and lights, and then we only...
Right.
Oh, air conditioning, potentially, if someone's suffering, like, I don't know, I can't... I can't. It's hard. It's hard. It's a gray area. It's a gray area. I can't tell you definitively what it is. I very often, as some of us have more tolerance than others, because I'm obviously the biggest fanatic in my family when it comes to this. You know, so I can tolerate more. Maybe some people can tolerate less. It's hard to know. If you're a little bit, there's this in general the notion of what's considered tsar. pain, distress when you can be leading in halakha. So, you know, what how do you define that? These things are very hard. There's a mild case, which is if you can't sleep at all, I would say. If you can't sleep at all, then I would say you would be allowed to go to a non-Jew. It's hard to know that we draw a line. Good question. Yeah.
What if it's still daylight out, so you have this, you know, the
yeah, that's
sun,
good. Then you can turn the lights.
So that he's
yeah, 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 on, yeah, yeah, yeah. If the daylight's out, and you can still see,
yeah.
then you can have.
It's gonna
yeah,
be dark
I would
soon.
Say even example, your home's on Shabbos, right? Let's say Shabbos day. Whatever, you like to have your dining room light on. Let's say, for example, it didn't go on, but you have a guest, you want to have these lights in addition to the daylight. You're allowed to go to your local Orthodox, goy or whatever, the local Orthodox Shabbos goy, and tell them, you know what, describe the situation, and they'd be allowed to do it. Okay. So, now, without getting, okay, you try, try to avoid the situation. It's not that you can't, but if there are sensors that go on, try to find out where the lights go on. Generally speaking, okay, Rabbi Willick Psak in this, generally speaking, is the following. If you're walking, triggers something, and that which is triggered, circuits are closed, and that provides a benefit to you. If it provides a benefit to you, then you should try to as much as you can to avoid it. So I'll give you two different cases. If whenever you walk in the hallway of the hotel, the light goes on during the daytime, there are windows during the daytime, that would not be a problem because it's not really doing any benefit for you. You can see in the daylight, maybe you can see a little bit better. If it's at nighttime. Sometimes you're stuck, so what can you do? But at night, it's a question. This is called psik reshe. This is called where if you do something and your goal is, I'm not trying to turn on the light. My goal is to walk to my room. But when you do something, what happens? Inevitably, something, a malacha, something that is forbidden on Shabbos happens. Okay? Now, your goal is to walk to your room. But what happens? As you're walking, then... So the light goes on. So that's an inevitable consequence. So if you are, for the most part, we would say that if you benefit from it, so we really should try to avoid it. Sometimes it's impossible. You should try to be in a hotel where you're not going to be in that situation. So again, the difference would be during the nighttime to walk through a hallway that's dark, and when you know that we're going to walk through, the light's going to go on. If you could wait for someone else to trigger that and walk with that person, that is certainly far better than you doing that during the day when you're walking. You don't have to wait, generally you could be lenient, and even if you trigger the light going on, if it's not providing a benefit for you, you can be lenient. Yeah.
So like there are electric doors that, you know, when you go close to them, they open up.
Yeah.
So if you waited for somebody else to walk through the door,
you
then you could go in.
Correct. Oh, yes. Yeah, sorry. I didn't mean it. That's another good point. Okay. Yeah. So electric doors, same thing also. You go, if a hotel has electric doors, you wait for someone to go in, and then you go in with them. Okay. Then you go in with them.
So that's the same thing with elevators?
Again, I would try to... Yeah, I would try to avoid elevators.
If you're on a cruise, like you're passing by, and there's
an elevator? Yeah, I would try to avoid elevators because sometimes, as a practical matter, you walk in, and then what happens? You get stuck, and then it closes on you, then it opens. As a practical matter, again, if it's a situation where someone is elderly or sick, it's hard for them to walk up the steps or down the steps. There's more room to be lenient. Elevator, you run into potential problem just because how many times you try to make sure that nothing's going to happen, and you know you walk in there and then you think the door's closing because you walk in, the door opens. It's when you have an electric door, You know, someone walks in, you walk in with them. So generally, that works out okay for the most part. But with an elevator, it's like a narrow door, and I would try to avoid it. Again, one could be lenient, you know, if you get off when someone else gets off and you walk the extra few steps. If you're in a very high floor, so there is room to be lenient potentially, but I would try to avoid unless someone is... you're right. If someone, technically speaking, if someone is going to the elevator and you go in with them and they go up and wherever they get off, you get off and you walk through many steps, that might be okay. I'm just saying in practice, very often mistakes are made and you inadvertently cause the doors to remain open or closed for, you know, by your own doing. Okay? Now, you're allowed to... Okay, you should light candles in your hotel room. And you can use electric lights if need be, and you can recite the bracha in this instance. I know people feel it's like they have to do their Shabbos candles. Okay, I don't wanna. And so sometimes the hotel, depending on it, they'll only allow you to do the Shabbos candles. They'll have like one little designated area wherever lights their Shabbos candles, and it's not where no one's eating there, no one's sleeping there. Generally speaking, the Shabbos candle is supposed to be a place where you can derive benefit from it. So let's say they have the Towering Inferno, where they have like a place set for everyone to light their Shabbos candles. And nobody's betting from it because there are so many lights on anyway. That's not what's the purpose of Shabbos candles? It's to help the ambiance of Shabbos to make, you know, either that maybe your room you need a light so you don't bump or trip, right? You don't walk in the pitch black, or it creates ambiance for the dining room where you're eating. So it's very questionable. It's very questionable for people who only light their candles in this towering inferno where they're not getting any benefit from it. And therefore, it's preferable. If people still want to do that, that's the only place where they let you light. So for me, it's preferable that they also turn on an electric light in their room and say before Shabbos, say that's also Lechavot Shabbos. If they have to make the bracha when they light the Towering Inferno, but also in mind for that, then I guess that's also okay. But I've told Yael this that you can just flip the switch on the bathroom light or some other light in your room that you're gonna need for Shabbos and make the bracha. But again, I know people feel very strongly about the candles, so if you have to. It's better. The best thing to do, if they let you use candles in your so the halacha when it comes to not Havdalah, when it comes to Shabbos, is the goal is to create light. Mm-hmm. It could be incandescent, it could be LED. There is some discussion, but the consensus of most postgame is any type of light that you're providing for Shabbos, Lechavod Shabbos. So that is that you're fulfilling the mitzvah of Lakos Neiros. So the goal is to provide light for you that you could use. So to light there where nobody's using that light at all, it's very questionable whether that satisfies something. But again, if people feel they want to do the candles, so okay, that's their custom. It's your custom. So do those candles, but do both. Yeah, I think if they also you want to do the candles, also do the candles. I mean, I don't have a problem with that. You want to do the candles, do the candles. But at the very least, I would be concerned of a bracha levatala, of a bracha in vain if you're only doing the candles. In other words, what I would do is flip a switch in your hotel room, and also light by the Towering Inferno, and make the bracha, and have in mind that it's also going on the lights in your room. Yes.
Last year at the Yarchikala, Rav Shefta gave a whole thing, and that they didn't even have a Towering Inferno.
Of course.
They gave us the lights and the yardside candles and told us exactly, it was 3 days.
Right.
And to do it in the room and just use those. He gave a whole
shiver. Yeah, okay.
And he said it's... Yeah, exactly what you're saying.
The last time Rav Shefta came here about 10, 12 years ago during the week, he scared everyone. Because what did he say? I remember this. He said that he's like, I don't know why people are lighting the second of Yom Tov. Because why? Because what did he do the second of Yom Tov? The lights are already on. You're only allowed to light on Yom Tov if it's for a purpose. If there's no purpose in you lighting, so like, why are you lighting? Because not only does it not help, but you're also doing havar. You might be violating a prohibition because what you're lighting for no purpose. If there's already light in the room and now you're lighting candles, so you're not doing it. So the second
is the aura for or the dining room table.
Right, so he's questioning whether that's really. Yeah, so he's questioning
that's
whether that's.
Friday night you have like.
No, but you're not machalish. But my point is here. You're doing it on Yom Tov itself. So I remember everyone was like, I remember this. Everyone was like looking. The men were like, whatever. The women were like, what's going on? So I remember sending out a follow-up email. I say, you know, we obviously we respect for Shetty. You should know that there are some who have a different view. I was told that his wife, I know for sure, that she made light the second day in like a dark corner somewhere where it's clearly dark, where you're clearly benefiting from it. But in any case, well, I don't know why I'm talking about this, but the point is, good, I'm glad he said, he doesn't need my approbation at all. Like, obviously, I got it from him probably, okay? The idea that it's much more preferred to use electric lights for Shabbos. Not talking Havdalah. Havdalah, you actually need H. You need fire. I'm talking about for Shabbos, then somewhere where no one's going to get any benefit from it. Okay, you can carry in a hotel room, in a hotel, even without an Eruv Chatzeros. The concept of, very briefly, an Eruv Chatzeros is, it used to be in the old days, where you had different houses emptying out into a courtyard. Okay? And the concern was, and everything was like, let's say everything was enclosed in a fence. So there was no, we were not talking about any Rishus HaRab, any public domain here. So the concern was that if everyone carried their stuff into the common courtyard, then people would think we're like carrying from our private houses to this public area. So then we can maybe carry from our house to the street, to really the public street. So they made some kind of thing called the Eruv Chatzeros, where they all collect food and they join together in one house and whatever the case is. So the question is, do you have to do that in a hotel that's outside the Eruv? We're not going to get into the discussion because we're sort of a little bit over time. But the point is, where Moshe fights in Igros Moshe Archaya, Chelak Aleph, Simon Kuf Mem Aleph, says there's no prohibition. There's a requirement of Eruv Chatzeros if you are a renter or you own a house, let's say that's outside, let's say, the Eruv. I do the Eruv Chatzeros for the whole community once a year, where we take a box of matzah, and I basically say that this matzah really works for everyone, and that we all own this box of matzah, so we're sort of creating a singular domain. That's a topic unto itself, but the point is that Ramosha holds that the person in the hotel room is not really considered a renter for these purposes, because the hotel management owns many of the items in the room. So therefore, you don't really have the law of a renter if the hotel management owns a lot of stuff in the room. Other posts can say that since, let's say, you're in this one hotel room and they can, for whatever reason, they can move you from one room to the next room. So you also don't really have quote unquote ownership over this room. And so for a variety of reasons, you don't need what's called an Eruv Chatzeros. You're allowed to carry throughout the hotel. Okay, not the grounds outside. Outside, I don't know if there's an Eruv or not, but I'm saying in the hotel itself. Okay, someone asked me a question about wearing a yarmulke on vacation. So I will point out the Nigros Moshe, Choshen Mishpat, Chelak Aleph, Simon, Tzadi Gimel. Ramosha Feinstein says that sometimes if you're going to work, wearing a yarmulke is a minhag, it's an important minhag, an important custom, but you would not have to lose your job if you feel that they feel that it could cost you your job if you wear a yarmulke. He said, by the way, if you're traveling to and from work, you should wear your yarmulke. You should only take it off when you're coming to work. It's not a leniency that's not to wear a yarmulke on the streets. I think Sfardim may have a different view of this, I think. So I don't want to say, in terms of Sfardim, they may have a different position. I don't know. But Ramosha's leniency does not allow people, as far as I know, to walk through the streets, you know, not wearing a yarmulke. That, specifically when they're going to work, when they're right about to come into work, so then they can take off your yarmulke. When they're riding the train, they should wear their yarmulke. So similarly, when they're on vacation, they should wear a yarmulke. If, obviously, they're going to, I don't know, Iran or Iraq. Now Iraq's in trouble now, right? So if they're going to a country where they're nervous with the rise of anti-Semitism, they're nervous, so wear a baseball hat, okay? So obviously, if you're nervous about wearing a yarmulke, so wear a baseball hat. You should always wear, cover your head. For work, for losing your job, so there there's a motion fight to have the potential leniency, but just go on vacation, you should cover your head. And if a yarmulke is a problem, so you should wear a baseball hat. Okay. Last issue. posting pictures of vacations on social media. Okay. Okay. So I spoke to one YU younger Rosh Hashiva about this. And this is sort of where I'm coming out on this. And it's interesting because I will tell you personally that the reason why I started going on Facebook a few years ago, I'm not saying people should go on Facebook necessarily. The reason why I went on Facebook is because someone told me that, you know, to promote the community, we also want to promote the rabbi. So to let people know my shiurim, my ideas, my thoughts, to share with people. I also what?
Your mountain climbing.
Yeah, so that's a question. So like, do I put up my mountain climbing? I put up other things. So like, I like struggle with it a little bit. So sometimes I feel, and this might be wrong, and this is my own personal cheshbon and nefesh. So sometimes like I may announce certain things, personal things, just to sort of humanize myself a little bit. You know, instead of always just posting shiurim, occasionally I'll post something about myself. But I think 95% of my posts are sharing ideas, sharing Torah, and I think about some of these things. I think about the fact that sometimes, you know, like there are people say, oh, please post pictures, you know, when you go somewhere. So there are a lot of people who are very happy when they see your pictures, but a lot of people are jealous because not everyone, you know, let's say I have a simcha, so a lot of people are very happy, and some people, for whatever reason, you know, they haven't, whatever, been successful in whatever it is, or they can't take this vacation, or they have trouble with the shidduch, or whatever the case is. So it's these things are not very easy, and I struggle with them. I'm not perfect, and I was sort of, when I was discussing this, so Adina sent me this question, so I was sort of reflecting on my own, and I was sort of reflecting on my own posts and how what do I do and how much and should I just, you know, like, there are some people who are interested. There, you know, as we know, some Facebook friends are not really friends. They're just people who are out there in cyberspace. I don't think there's a medium, you know, to send to all your friends on, I don't know, an email. Here are some pictures. You know, they people generally send through Facebook. I quote here the Orchos Chaim in Perek Yadal, chapter 14, writes that many people cause others to be jealous of them when they wear fancy clothing, and they would thereby violate the prohibition of Lifnei Iver. Because they're causing other people, they're placing a stumbling block in front of other people, they're causing other people to be jealous. Again, it's very hard to know. It's like a balance. Because some people, you're bringing tremendous joy. People are very happy that you told them. And some other people could be jealous. Conspicuous behavior often leads to jealousy. Rav Dester writes that Ayin Hara is an impact of causing if you cause someone to be jealous, so that could lead to an Ayin Hara. Again, even if you understand that rationally, that what's Ayin Hara, you're doing something conspicuously, ostentatiously, and you're causing other people to be jealous. So that could be an Ayin Hara, it could be jealousy. There's a mystical approach also what Ayin Hara is. But even a rationalist, you're causing this. There's a value of being modest, hatznei aleches, and not causing undue attention to ourselves. So these things are a hard balance. I can't paskin definitively. I'm happy that the question was asked because it gave me an opportunity to reflect. Again, I use this platform mostly to share Torah ideas and Torah thoughts and some of my shiurim. But you know, obviously the pictures get the most likes. But okay, sometimes I feel like it's almost expected when you're telling someone about a certain event. Oh, my daughter graduated and this. Okay, so like you're sharing news, you know, my son got engaged, you're sharing news. So, you know, as opposed to, you have to balance these things. I can't give you something very definitive about it, but, you know, it's a different world out there on Facebook nowadays. So we should keep in mind that there are people out there that were posting things that they're going to be jealous. We're causing people to be jealous of us. That's what's going to happen. How you sort of balance this, I don't know. I don't have the answer. You post nothing. You post maybe one picture, a nice family picture, maybe that. I'm reflecting on this myself. I think maybe sometimes I may go overboard here or there. I might do something cute. Something, again, I'll be honest with you. Sometimes I post things just to show, like, because I think people want a rabbi to apparently to appear to be approachable, to be real, exactly. Right? Right. You know what I'm talking about, Helene. They want to be real. Okay. So sometimes I'm going to show like I'm actually a human being, that I actually do things that real people do, that I'm not somewhere outside in the sky. So I know I'm I'm reflecting that something goes through my head when I post certain things, but probably I have to see, you know, how much and my cause people be jealous about different things. So we should keep that in mind in general. This is a social media is like a total different world. There are major advantages about this. There are major advantages of social media. A lot of things that there's like Ask the Beit Midrash, there are Makoros. When I have questions, I post things and people, you know, from the cyber world, whatever, cyberspace, they send me suggestions and sometimes I see different ideas that people are thinking about and different trends. So I learn a little bit about what's going on, about what people are thinking about in the Jewish world, the broader world, a little bit. I don't spend a tremendous amount of time like surfing, you know, just for sake, you know, for surfing. Sometimes I'm interested in what's going on in the Jewish world, what people are talking about, because I want to try to provide sometimes a Torah perspective, if I can, on what's going on in the world. That's sort of, so for me, I use this as an outlet to share my ideas, to see what's going on in the world that may warrant me commenting about it. And occasionally I'll post an event that's of significance to let people know, to show that I'm a human being and I'm a real person. These are things that I was glad I had this discussion with this Rosh Yeshiva, because I was also reflecting on my own use, and it's important to try to be certainly moderate when it comes to this. Okay?
Thank you, Rabbi.
Okay.